the things that inspire us, the things that our kind evolved with, the fierce, the majestic, the fleet, just disappear one by one because there's simply no room left for other big critters.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Doug Chadwick, whose book, Four-Fifths a Grizzly, A New Perspective on Nature That Just Might Save Us All, is a book that begs its readers to reconsider the concept of the single self. Doug Chadwick has written 13 books about wildlife and conservation, including Yellowstone to Yukon, The Wolverine Way, and Tracking Gobi Grizzlies. He lives in Whitefish, Montana. Doug, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here, of course, and let's go.
Let's go. Even though its message is philosophical, sort of ethical, there's, you know, a ton of scientific information. There are these beautiful photographs. It is kind of a multi-genre book. I'm wondering how you actually conceived of this type of book, because it's not easily categorized.
No, it's not. And that's purposeful. And look, I've written 15 books, and most of them are, not most of them, but a large share of them are about single species that needed attention. You know, that's my job. I'm a cheerleader for wildlife, for ecosystem. And so I'm arm waving for wolverines, or I'm arm waving for whales. And, or they're about places that need, individual places that need special protection. They need more care and concern. And I realized at the pace nature is being denatured across the globe, in a world of 8 billion people, this wasn't cutting it. I had to take on the nature of nature and how we think about nature. And I had no idea how I was going to do it. I'm not convinced I do now, but I'm a wildlife biologist by training. And so I'm always feeling like my colleagues are looking over my shoulder. And popularizing wildlife is not their favorite thing. It's, you're being sensational. You're being, you're not sticking to the facts. You know, it has to read more like a scientific paper. And so I'm always fighting that, but I wanted to be able to give this to, you know, my neighbor and high school kids who are taking high school biology, but doesn't have the oomph of who are we really? How does nature really work? And so when I noticed that I had two paragraphs, as you said, it looked like textbook, I panicked, you know. And I would say, now, you know, if I do one more paragraph like this, they're going to throw the book away and they're going to go get something exciting and or turn on the TV or whatever. And that was my solution anyway, was to mix in adventures and some philosophy and just plain having some fun. And if conservation ain't fun, why are we doing it? Sure, to save ourselves and save the planet. But as we all know, that there's a lot of doom and gloom in all that. And I've always reacted to friends and colleagues who, wonderful people, but when they give a talk, they look like they just lost their best friend and someone in their family died, and they're telling people how awful everything is. Here's another fact you might not know that's just horrifying. And they wonder why they don't reach a larger audience. And at this stage, what's going on in the world, environmental catastrophes, or at least crises, are ubiquitous. And I think people are overwhelmed by them. And it occurred to me that not only was focus on single crises or species one at a time, we don't have time for that, but that the fundamental problem is we're trying to save nature and most people don't understand what nature is or how it works or its relationship to what's going on with them. So this is my shot at trying to blend all of that. And it's a goulash.
I mean, the subtitle of the book is A New Perspective on Nature That Just Might Save Us All. What makes Four Fifths a Grizzly different from previous books about the relationship between the human and the more than human worlds? What makes this perspective new?
We're embedded in nature, but it's not as clear to people that nature is embedded within us. That's why the title of Four Fifths of Grizzlies is my way of getting at the fact that I share at least 80% of my DNA with the likes of grizzly bears. If I had called it Four Fifths of a Duck-billed Platypus, probably not such good marketing. But I am, I'm Four Fifths of Snow Leopard. I'm Four Fifths fruit bat flying through the jungle. And I mean, I take that seriously. We're built and designed by the same DNA, some of it new and some of it old before life came out of the sea. So we're connected that way. If you were to grind me up and throw me in a mass spectrometer, you would find that the great majority of DNA in my body is microbial. And that's because I've got 30 trillion human cells and at least that many cells of bacteria, archaea, protozoans, but from thousands of different species. So the spectrum of DNA in me is not what I think of as me. So I go through life functioning as thinking of myself in a I, me, mine frame of mind, but I function as an us.
Yeah, and you write this in the book.
Yeah,
too.
I do. And then inside each of our cells, we're powered by mitochondria. And that's what you see in high school biology is what's called an organelle, one of many little bodies inside each cell. What they don't always tell you is that's a modified bacterium. So that makes us a symbiont. That makes us in partnership with trillions of these things. We have a few in some cells. We have up to 2,000 in hardworking cells like the liver. And they power everything we do. If you don't have mitochondria, you cannot stay alive. And so that's us too. I could go on about symbiosis definitely, but it's partnerships, it's combinations. I call us combo critters. And for some reason, the way humans think of themselves is as special. That's okay. We have amazing qualities, but we're not separate. And we tend to think of ourselves that way also. So that makes taking care of nature something we can choose to do. It's an option. It's a special interest. It's a hobby. It's a philosophy. It's something that suits some groups of people, but we don't think of it as taking care of ourselves in a fundamental way. We are nature.
Do you think that in order for conservation to be successful, in order to save this planet, as your book kind of outlines, that we have to have stake in it? We are going to let other species die until we are the ones dying, and then we're like, oh, wait, hold on. So do we need to have a stake in order to care?
I don't know. We're pretty good at deluding ourselves and living in magical territory. And again, conservation, we specialize in trying to argue people into conserving a living planet. The only one we know in the universe. I don't know why we have to do that, really. But you can tell people you have to save this rare plant because it might hold the cure for cancer. Or you have to save biological diversity as a whole because it makes ecosystems stable. And, a lot of arguments. And I think telling people they have to do something doesn't really work. People have to see the nature in themselves. And so in addition to our genetic ties to all the living world, we're 7% of our DNA is shared with bacteria I'm 24% a wine grape. I mean, you know, come on, everything. Yeah, yeah. I'm in them, them, they're in me. We share that. But in addition to that, instead of going out and telling people you have to do this and working on guilt and or a sense of obligation, I have a couple of chapters about when I talk about the nature in us, literally the nature in us that responds to being in contact with natural systems or out in a natural setting. And I think that's so important. I don't know why that isn't more often talked about. Doctors are recommending people spend more time outdoors.
And you call this forest bathing.
Well, the high-end part of it is forest bathing, when you go on a guided tour and you immerse all your senses in a green space. And if you do that in Japan or South Korea, your health insurer will pay for it. That's how healthful it is. Why? Because when you're in contact with nature, your heart rate slows, your blood pressure drops, your immune system gets strengthened, and your cognitive abilities sharpen and focus. And it's a more relaxed concentration. And it's an antidote to the high stress, anxiety producing modern world. Not that one's good or bad, but the balance is a bit out of whack. And you don't have to go out and climb Mount Awesome to be in contact with nature. You don't have to go on a two-week rumble through the jungle. You can go look at a garden. You can sit on a park bench in a small urban park and just take it in. The strongest argument I can think of for environmental protection is not the usual sort of approach to people say, oh, by the way, Mr. Man on the Street or Mrs. Big Time Politician, would you be interested in being happier, healthier, and living longer? Oh, you would. How about making more protective measures for the nature we have left?
This book seems to be a call to action, or at least it is telling its readers that there's a different way to think about our relationship to and in the natural world. How does this perspective, how does this new way of looking at the world, how will it change the world? What is the direct call to action here?
Well, I think if we see ourselves as part of a greater whole, and we see ourselves as kin to the rest of life, our kind arose 350,000 years ago, Homo sapiens. We didn't hit our first million in population until 12,000 years ago. We didn't hit our first billion until around 1800, and now we're at 8 billion. And that graph is a straight skyrocket towards the sky now in terms of numbers. And it's exactly the opposite for the number of companions from other species we have on this planet.
Yeah, I think I you're going to have to tell me whether I'm remembering this correctly, but I think you said that we've lost nearly 70% of our biodiversity on the planet.
That is the vertebrates.
The vertebrates,
our kin with backbones from fish on up to mammals. That's just in the last half century. Our population more than doubled in the last 50 years, and the population of vertebrates, this is not different species, just sheer numbers, declined by 70%. And then at the moment, if you take the living weight or biomass of our fellow mammals, the total weight of humans is about, I don't know, 23-24% of the total. All the rest, except for 4%, is our livestock. And that 4% is all the wild mammals that still exist.
That's an insane statistic.
So, in other words, the alternative is to spend the rest of our time here watching the likes of rhinos and snow leopards and giraffes and the things that inspire us, the things that we evolve, our kind evolved with, the big, the fierce, the majestic, the fleet, the just impossibly beautiful, just disappear one by one because there's simply no room left for other big critters in a world of 8 billion people with advanced technology, unless we do choose to make room for them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Doug Chadwick, the author of Four Fifths a Grizzly. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I mean, one thing I think that your book does really, really well is you're talking about the beauty and the majestic nature of a lot of these sort of these wild creatures, right? And these are the creatures that when you're thinking about the wild, you think about, even the grizzly bear, right? The more than human. But something that your book does really well, it made me as a reader anyway, see the beauty in the microscopic. And that leads me to take a step back to the beginning of the book, the entrance into the book. You begin Four Fifths a Grizzly with your childhood. So tell our listeners how you came to science.
Easy. My dad gave me a microscope. And he was a geologist who used it for mineral structure observations. And I was a 7, 8, I can't remember, but a kid. And I didn't think of myself as a geek. I was a baseball player. I should have been pitching for the Yankees as far as I was concerned. But I got this microscope and I got a drop of dirty pond water or puddle somewhere near the house and put it under the lens. And my God, it was just filled with creatures I'd never imagined exist. And as I did this over and I'm running around the house grabbing bread mold and cat fur and dust and anything I can find. And it's all alive at some level. And by the time I was 10, I realized that probably 99% of what we call life on the living planet is invisible. And it's also wondrous. You know, 8% of our, this is later, but about 8% of our own DNA is of viral origin. So there's things going on at the microscopic level that we're only starting to translate right now, to interpret and understand. But that microscopic world that's what makes the planet most alive. It runs everything. That's what is producing the oxygen in the air. It's controlling our health, is controlling the fertility of the planet, is everything. And that's kind of hard to think about because you can't see it. But when I talk about our greater selves and our connections to all other life, yeah. I'm really proud of the fact I started off as a microbe. I was a fertilized egg, 4/1,000 of an inch in diameter, and there were bacteria bigger than I was. And, look at me. I did good. But how can I think of myself separately when I went through this, shape-shifting process? I've been all kinds of things in my life.
I mean, that kind of brings us back to this idea of the compound creature. And you write in the book, everyone functions like this. Taken together, the invisible multitudes on and in us redefine every person as a kind of, as I've said, a compound creature, a combination of organisms. And you stated something about symbiosis, but there's another term in the book that I'd like you to kind of elaborate on and talk about, and I'm going to slaughter the pronunciation of it, the holobiont.
Good. Yeah.
Wonderful. Multi-creature collaboration.
Yeah.
Can you explain that term and how it differs or how it is the same from symbiosis or a symbiotic relationship?
Sure. A symbiosis is between two species. So that would be a lichen most people are familiar with, or a coral, which built much of the world, by the way. I remember I was up at 10,000 feet in the Bighorn Mountains in Wyoming, and I'm crawling through a tunnel. I'm caving, and I'm crawling through a tunnel, and I'm on my back, and my headlamp's looking up at the ceiling, which is right above my nose, but it's all made of coral from about 500 million years ago. And they're a symbiont. They're a polyp, like a miniature anemone, combined with photosynthesizing algae. Okay.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. And then I started looking at, okay, here's a tree. And that tree is a combination of what we call a plant, but it's got a 90% of all the ones we've looked at so far, probably much higher, their roots are connected to microscopic fungi that increase the area that gives them access to scarce water and nutrients by about 10 times. And in their leaves are mitochondria. All the animals got them. All the plants got them. And so that's a symbiotic bacteria. And the photosynthesis, the milling sunlight into energy, basically, the basis of all food chains, that's also a symbiotic cyanobacteria. Okay? And if you're looking at an African acacia, say, on the plains of East Africa, looking at all that wildlife out there, look again at the whistling thorn acacia, and it's got inflated thorns that serve as nests for ants. And those ants it also makes nectaries, which are sweet little portions on the end of its leaves to feed the ants. And the ants are running around over the leaves, defending that plant from insect grazers. And the ants have symbiotic bacteria in grooves on their feet that produce toxins that the ants spread around as they travel over the tree, and those defend the leaves against fungi and harmful bacteria. Oh, and then the roots are also not special nodules that host nitrogen-fixing bacteria, and nitrogen is helping that acacia grow. That's the key to cell structure. So where's the individual here? There are all these individual symbioses, but it's a community of symbiotic, or a community of symbioses, but that's what makes, I'd say, more organisms than not. They're not just symbionts, they are holobionts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So a symbiotic relationship would be between two organisms, and where a holobiont would be many.
Yeah.
Like multiple.
I always like to say, when you look more closely at nature, you always find a whole greater than the sum of its parts. I like the term holobiont because it implies a whole greater than the sum of its parts. That's holistic. We are holobionts composed of a number of different symbiotic organisms. They're not all symbiotic with one another, but of these partnerships. So part of the way we look at nature, I was talking earlier about, we like to think of ourselves as separate. When I study biology, I thought of ecosystems as a kind of long list of species. That's biodiversity. Here's all the plants, here's all the animals. We know they interact and stuff, but I didn't think of them as each of those species as being holding and operating through a whole series of interactions within itself, mm-hmm. as well as between other species. Mm-hmm. So it's easier for us to understand things if we divide them into categories.
Right. And there's a really, really wonderful line in the book that said something about how humans like to divide things into categories that are a lot more specific than how the world actually operates.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's sort of time to put these things back together if we want to understand nature. We need to be looking at the combinations, at the holistic view of what creatures are and what ecosystems are, instead of looking at it as a series of separate separate collections of organisms. An ecosystem is as much about processes and interactions as it is about who's there. And we depend on them because we are part of that. I mean, look, I'm trying to avoid the climate change and what's happening to our atmosphere, what's happening to our seas. I mean, the Earth is being transformed. And everyone's aware of it at that level. But you asked the tough question, which is, how does seeing things as more connected, what is going to spark people to change their view of themselves, of what we're doing right now? Why change? And I don't know that I answered that. I don't know exactly what the answer is, because, you know, it works for me to see nature in a different, more connected way. But I'm not sure people who live in urban areas or, you know, have totally different interests see it that way. And this is why we environmentalists are always trying to scare or shock or warn people, you know, you got to get active. And I think enough people believe that we've sort of liberated ourselves from nature that it's not necessarily important. And that's why when I'm talking to someone and they say, I hear what you're saying, but I'm just not in that into nature myself. And I see, yeah, nature's totally into you. I mean, you of course you're into nature. You just don't know it, and you don't know who you are. So, I have one thing I could read that kind of gets at that.
Oh, sure. Let's take a moment to hear from the book itself.
An artist commissioned to illustrate the way many folks think about our position in the living world might paint a scene with us as the shining capstone atop a grand pyramid of species. Instead, the growing collection of revelations from recent studies sticks humankind within a tangled skein of other life forms. Your every friend, enemy, lover, dignitary, and desperado, along with every other animal, every plant, and every fungus you'll ever meet, exists as a union. It means each of us is, by nature, a collaboration or collective, a joint venture of fellow earthlings. Our newly realized position doesn't undermine our prowess and potential. Our spectrum of biological relationships makes us more than human, and being human was already pretty marvelous. For we possess an extraordinary brand of imaginative intelligence, coupled with social mechanisms for sharing and building upon information that appear to be unrivaled. So make of those qualities all you will. But for goodness sake, don't look for insights from anybody not particularly interested in the fate of nature on a living planet, much less willing to do something about it. That holobiont missed the memo to know thyself.
You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Tom Barich. A special thanks to Beth Ann Austin for her guidance and humor over the last 13 years. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.